I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. No one likes to be interrupted. It can make you feel silenced, that what you're saying doesn't matter, that the other person isn't listening or they care more about what they have to say than you. When you drill down, though, it's not so simple because there can be cultural differences when it comes to interrupting, with some cultures believing it's rude and others experiencing it as the natural give and take of conversation. Our guest, Deborah Tannen, has spent her career listening to and watching people talk to each other and says there's yet another way to understand what can look and sound like interrupting. She calls it cooperative overlapping, interjecting in a conversation to show enthusiasm to encourage the other person to keep talking. She had an opinion piece in the New York Times that caught our eye, writing, "Mutual interruptions can rev up the conversation, inspiring speakers to greater conversational heights." Deborah Tannen is professor of linguistics at Georgetown University, wrote a book back in 1990 that was a bestseller, You Just Don't Understand, Men and Women in Conversation. She's written many books since that time, and her most recent book is a memoir titled Finding My Father. Deborah Tannen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
What a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's begin with, I guess, what happens in the classroom, which is some definitions here. What is the main difference between interrupting and what you call cooperative overlapping?
Interrupting is an attempt to steal the floor. Somebody is speaking, they have a right to it, and you're grabbing it away from them. It's like a grand larceny. But cooperative overlapping is when a listener talks along. They're intending it as a show of enthusiastic listenership. I'm really engaged in what you're saying. I get it. And when people share that style and understand the style and use it, it can actually encourage them to keep going. So that's the big difference. Is it an intention to steal the floor, or is it an intention to show engagement?
Well, let me play a clip, and this is actually a clip that you sent us, recorded, more than 40 years ago. You went to a Thanksgiving dinner with some friends, taped the conversation, and this became some of the basis of your research, and I think really underscores what it was you were just describing to us. It's about 30 seconds.
Coliseum.
It's where the beginning of what side is.
Oh, right. What's the Coliseum?
59th and...
What is it? An office building.
Well, 59, Columbus Circle.
Did they give you
Columbus Circle? Is that Columbus Circle?
Here's Columbus Circle.
It's the Huntington Hartford Museum, right?
No. Here's Central Park West. Here's Broadway. We're going north this way. Uh-huh. And here's this building here. The Huntington Hartford is on the south. The
So that's what you're talking about there, Deborah Tannen.
Yes. I love that clip because there were six of us there. Three of us were from New York. Two were from California, one was British. And I had started out thinking that I was going to look at everybody's conversational style and how it affected the interaction. But in the end, I could only really understand the style of the New Yorkers because it was hard for the others to get the floor. This is a discussion of a place in New York, Columbus Circle, is especially revealing because only the three New Yorkers were taking part. But one of the others, the woman from England, she actually knew exactly what the speaker was talking about, but she couldn't get in there. And there was a point where I say, that's the Huntington Hartford, right? And you hear another voice saying, that's the Huntington Hartford, right? It turns out we were wrong. How could we both be wrong? Well, it turns out, because I interviewed everybody afterwards, the other person who said, it's the Huntington Hartford, he didn't really know. But he figured I would know, and so he echoed what I was saying to be a good cooperative overlapper. So he would show enthusiastic engagement. And so that's very revealing. It's all about a rhythm of conversation. How long a pause do you expect between turns? When is it appropriate to take the floor? And when people grow up in different places, have different backgrounds, their sense of rhythm is different. And it can be hard to get the floor.
Well, that's interesting. And it sounds like it was hard for some of the people at this Thanksgiving to get the floor because there was no ability to feel like you could jump in on the conversation or add something to the conversation.
Yes, we all have a sense of how long a pause would be normal. when you figure, okay, now I can take it. And it's not absolute. One person expects a short pause, one expects a long pause. It's always relative. In this conversation, the New Yorkers expected shorter pauses, or in some cases, we actually prefer, I say we because I was one of the New Yorkers in the conversation. There's a sense, because this goes along with the whole ethic and value system about interaction. Silence is to be avoided because it feels like the conversation is running down. So you try to fill anything that looks like it might be a pause. That made it hard for the Californians to get in. But a Californian talking to somebody from New England, they might be the ones who end up interrupting. And someone from New England speaking to, say, a native Alaskan, they might be the ones who are interrupting because of the length of pauses that are expected in those cultures.
Well, thinking about pauses, and on the radio, you know, pauses are death. Although sometimes you can use them to some dramatic effect. But the idea of kind of filler words or nodding heads, I mean, there are all sorts of small ways to encourage a conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad you said that about dramatic pauses, because the same speakers who were overlapping quickly often had very long pauses within a turn, telling a story, because, as you say, the long pause stands out. So it's a good way to build up to the point of your story. But yeah, you can show your listening. I call it participatory listenership. And actually, all listening is participatory. You have to do something to show that you're listening. And it could be silent, you're just looking, keeping the eye gaze. It could be nonverbal, it could be small words, yeah. Could be little phrases, I know what you mean. And they can just get longer and longer, and there's some point at which each person will feel, this person is going on so long, they're no longer listening, they want to take the floor.
Yeah.
But it's different for different people.
Well, as you wrote, you know, these mutual interruptions, and I think our listeners understand what you're talking about, can rev up the conversation, inspiring speakers to greater conversational heights. So, and I do want to talk about interrupting, but cooperative overlapping is actually enhances the conversation. What, if it's done right with people who know how to play the game?
Yes. Conversations always can go well if people have a similar style and if they both agree that mutual interruptions show we're really excited about this. I have so much to say that I just can't wait. And they're both doing it equally. It's the balance that means both of them can end up with adrenaline, and the adrenaline kind of makes your mind sharper. But if you are not used to a conversation like that, the adrenaline can just tie your tongue and you find it hard to get in. I love this example. I was on a talk show around the time that book came out, and somebody called in and said, yeah, you know, after we have this great dinner party, and then my husband will accuse me of hogging the floor and locking him out. She said, he's a big boy. He can get in same as anybody else. And then I heard this voice behind her explaining why he couldn't. He said, you need a crowbar to get into those conversations. By the way, you were hearing I was using those dramatic pauses.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And that is how it feels. If you don't share the style and you don't perceive the length of pause you need, or, you know, maybe the intonation pattern, you know, your voice kind of peters out and you realize the person's running out of steam. They're giving me the floor that way. If you don't share those cues, then you really can't get in.
Let me read. This was a letter to the editor to the New York Times to your piece. This is from a guy named Joseph Lovett. He's a documentary filmmaker. And he wrote, I love this, kind of speaks to what you were talking about. He says, I remember coming home to Thanksgiving my freshman year in college, where I had been away from the free-for-all conversations of my large opinionated family. The discourse had become so frenetic, I stood up and yelled, is it not possible for one person in this family to get from a capital letter to a period without interruption? And then he writes, they had no idea what I was talking about.
I love that, because saying a capital letter to a period, that is so brilliant. when we think you should say an entire sentence, we're really basing it on a concept of language that comes from written language. Oh. And spoken language doesn't really work that way. We don't talk in sentences, we talk in phrases. But many people experience that if you move from a place where one style is the norm to a place where another style is the norm. One of the speakers in my own, in that Thanksgiving dinner that I analyzed, he was the one actually who tagged on and said, that's the Huntington Hartford, right, when he didn't really know because he'd been living in California. He actually told me afterwards that it was hard for him. He was struggling to take part because he had gotten rusty. But he also said that his wife accuses him of interrupting.
Oh.
So, yeah, but there are people who grow up in conversational style places where you always wait your turn. We're all waiting our turn, but you
wait,
realize you have
quietly.
A turn because you're waiting for the pause, right? You have long pauses, pauses that to you feel long enough that you can get in. And they move to a place where it's a more lively conversational style, and they say, I found my people. No, they're more comfortable with that. And then you get others who move to a slower-paced area and say they prefer that. So there are a lot of individual differences.
Well, indeed. And what I hear you say, Deborah Tannen, is that when we're talking about, I guess, just talking in general, but also cooperative overlapping, that it is a regional thing or it is a familial thing. And that, you know, finding that niche is like finding your people.
Absolutely. It is ethnic, regional, cultural. When I talk about and write about these phenomena, I hear from people who say they come from an Italian family, a Greek family, an Arab family, an Armenian family, places all over the world, and they'll say that's how we did it. So, it isn't that it is inborn, you know, because of that ethnicity. It's just you get used to it because the people that you grow up speaking with speak that way. So it's learned the same way you learn language. Hearing the people around you speak.
Well, we're up on a break, and as you're talking, I'm reminded of that scene from Annie Hall, the dinner scene where, you know, you have her very straight-laced, waspy family sitting in kind of tense, uninterrupted silence, and then his family, they're all over each other, they're interrupting each other, they're carving up each other's meals and talking about people's digestive problems.
Yeah, I love that scene, but it really shows you the extreme view of that style from an outsider. And I think doesn't Woody Allen show up dressed like a Hasid with
did.
The
he
side
does.
Curls? Yeah, because he's saying this is a stereotype.
Well, that is Deborah Tannen, our guest on Radio Times today. She's a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. She's written a whole bunch of books, including one that was a bestseller for a number of years, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. She's got a new book, relatively new book. It's a memoir titled Finding My Father. We're talking about interrupting and something she calls cooperative overlapping. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Deborah Tannen about something she has coined, a phrase she has coined, cooperative overlapping, how talking at the same time can be a complement to a conversation. Talking also about the give and take of communication, the language of listening. We're going to be talking more about gender and talking styles and how to handle people who filibuster. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us the old-fashioned way, 1-888-477-9499. Let me play a clip, and this is from a 2015 comedy sketch produced by College Humor called The Guy Who Listens by Interrupting You. Let's give it a listen.
I feel like you're not actually listening to me.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Are you
actually
not listening to me,
no,
or
get,
are you saying that you get
sure.
that it seems
yeah,
that
totally,
way?
Yeah, totally, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, you need to stop that.
Okay, doing what?
You need to stop checking in with me so much saying yeah. You need to stop saying yeah.
What do you mean?
It seems like you're not listening and that you're just focusing
got
on saying
it. Yeah,
and
no, that
got
makes
it
sense.
And everything.
Yeah.
Like you took some kind of active listening class,
sure,
but you're not actually paying attention.
Totally. Okay, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what was that, Deborah Tannen? What are we listening to?
Yeah. That is exaggerations, actually, of two aspects, I think, of interrupting. And it's been shown to characterize women and men as a tendency. Nothing is all women, all men. But you hear the woman's voice repeatedly saying, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, these kind of little utterances that show listening and enthusiasm. It turns out that women do tend to do that more than men do. And it often gives men the feeling that the women aren't listening. They're uh-huh. rushing you along. And on the other hand, we do know it has been shown by a lot of research that men do tend to interrupt women more often than women interrupt men. In fact, one study found that Supreme Court justices, the women are interrupted more often than the men by their colleagues. And this is really astonishing, by advocates who are taking part in oral argument.
Is that true today, you think?
Yes. Yeah, it's a pretty recent study. Mm. And they find that it's against the rules. You know, debates have rules and oral argument has rules. And it's against the rules for the advocate to interrupt the justice. But they do it, and they do it more often to the women. So that little clip shows, I think, both sides of that.
Let me read a couple of comments. Here's a tweet from Elena. She says, interruption is good for mutual flow. Let the creativity thrive and interrupt men. Just for fun, exclamation point. Anything on that, Deborah Tannen?
Well, I think it's really important. I really tried to make a distinction between interruption and cooperative overlapping. Overlapping just sort of tells you what you hear. It's descriptive, two voices going at once. But when you talk about the intention, that's interpretation. Mm-hmm. Because when you walk away from a conversation, you don't think of describing, you know, oh, that was a little awkward. I think you may expect a millisecond shorter pause than I do. Hmm. But you walk away with impressions about people and about the relationship. You know, you're not interested in what I have to say. You only want to hear yourself talk. Or on the other side, and that's so important to realize, on the other side, how come you're not doing your part in this conversation? Hmm. There's another anecdote I love. A couple, now married and happy, told me that on their first date, he was doing all the talking, and she was starting to think, you know, who wants to spend any more time with this guy? And at one point, he stopped and he said, could you help me out here?
Oh, interesting.
And he just pointed out that he was filling in the pauses because she wasn't.
And those pauses, sort of waiting. I mean, even if it's a nanosecond, he was waiting for her to jump in.
Yes, he really thought that she wasn't participating, because he felt he was leaving pauses long enough for her to come in, and but she wasn't perceiving those pauses. So the intentions can always be misread by conversational style differences. That really is the overall point, I guess, of all my research on conversational style. Pacing and pausing, you know, whether you leave long pauses or not, or what the rhythm is, that's only one part of it. You know, there is also how direct or indirect you tend to be. You know, if you say, it's cold in here, do you expect someone to know that you're asking them to close the window? And aspect of, you know, how close do you stand? If you, it's just really a parallel to what we're saying. You know, one person keeps closing in because they want to get that comfortable space, and the other one keeps backing up to get that larger comfortable space, and they can work their way down the hall because of that a difference like that. So it's all about ways we take for granted that we think this is polite, this is kind, this is the way you do it, and when you interact with people who are doing it a different way, it's so automatic to think they're rude, they have no manners. This, back again, I'll tell this one quickly. I had a grad student from Texas, and she sent her mother, actually it was an audio cassette of an interview I had done where I talked about this, and her mother's response was, well, the one thing that she doesn't get it to is that people in the North have no manners.
Oh.
And that's what it all comes down to. It's our right. idea of what manners are. And I just remember many, many people of the style. It's very easy to understand, oh, yeah, you're interrupting me. That's no manners. But it is just as instinctive to blame the other person if they're not taking part in the conversation. And you don't know that it's just rhythm. Yeah.
And there I was interrupting you.
Oh, please do.
No, that's okay. But I was thinking as you were describing, especially the space that the people feel comfortable having between them as a kind of a dance, that a conversation is, especially if it goes well. And I think we can often feel that when you just feel a connection to someone and there is this ebb and flow and the kind of chemistry that goes, that it is a kind of dance.
I love that metaphor. Yes. And you can think of a couple dancing or a line dancing. And if you share the rhythm, you feel you're lifted into another level. I sometimes use this metaphor. A perfectly tuned conversation is a vision of sanity.
Oh, wow.
It's a feeling that you're a good person, they're a good person, all's right with the world. But the opposite, of course, also, unfortunately, is true. Mm. And people have found, again, this is research, that people who have grown up in different cultures find it hard to pick up that rhythm. Uh-huh. And also people with schizophrenia, one study showed, find it hard to pick up that rhythm, which is why you feel kind of crazy when you can't.
Interesting. Here's a comment from Tommy. A lively conversation often includes interrupting, but when I'm busy thinking ahead of the clever and insightful response I want to interject, I'm missing part of what the other person is saying, then part of the conversation is lost as a result. I mean, there is the listening part, and I think doesn't get as much credit as it probably should as such an important part of any conversation.
Yes, I love that comment too. But here's my take on it. Conversational styles are not one little bit and one other little bit. It's always a system, and the systems go together. So one thing, and this is, I think, reflecting what this commenter is saying, one side of it was, if you don't give me a place to come in, I'm blaming you for that. And the other was, it's my job to find a place to come in. And I was counting how many times a person with this style, I actually call the style high involvement, kept trying to get his point in. Hmm. And the highest number was 7. So he tried to make a point. People talked over him. He tried again. People talked over him. He tried again. And he just kept trying until he got that point made. So that's the ecosystem. But you don't have to watch out for other people. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, but that's a lot of work.
It's automatic.
7 tries to get in, right?
Well, all this stuff is automatic. Yeah, it can seem like it. And it's impossible, again, if it's not a style that you're comfortable with, that you've grown up with, it would be unthinkable to just keep trying. If nobody picked up your point even twice, you would think, well, I'll just give it up.
Right.
But if it's automatic, then it would just seem pretty natural. And that's why I think you have to think of all these things together. What the speaker can do and what the listener can do are going to be, it's an ecosystem, and each style has its own.
And that is Deborah Tannen. She's a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. She's written a bunch of books about how we talk to each other, how we miscommunicate with each other. She wrote a memoir recently called Finding My Father. And we called her up to be a guest on Radio Times today because we saw a piece she had in the New York Times recently, which took an interesting look at what can appear to be interruptions, but she calls it cooperative overlapping, giving us a chance to talk about how we talk to each other. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me play two more clips. Now, these are political debates. So these have their own rules, even though they're broken by the candidates all the time. but I want to play them just to give us a chance to talk about political discourse. The first one is Donald Trump. Hillary Clinton took to their podiums. This is a 2016 presidential debate, but often found themselves speaking over each other and sometimes over the moderator, Lester Holt. It's about 30 seconds. Let's give it a listen.
I think a lot about what worked and how we can make it work again.
Well, he approved
3 million
NAFTA.
New jobs,
he approved
a balanced
NAFTA,
budget.
Which is the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country.
Incomes went up.
No, no, you're telling the enemy everything you want to do.
No, we're not.
See, you're
no,
telling the not. Enemy everything
we
you
are.
Want to do.
I wrote about that in...
You called it the gold standard.
About, well, I hope...
You called it the gold standard of trade
and
deals. You
know
said
what?
It's the finest deal you've ever seen.
No,
and
but when it was negotiated,
not.
Which I wrote about that...
So is it President Obama's fault? Is it President Obama's fault?
Even announced.
Deborah Tannen, any thoughts about that?
Oh, it's painful to
listen
to.
It is very painful.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, yes. Well, there are a debate, a real debate, has rules, and usually they're not broken. You get a certain amount of time to talk, the other one gets a certain amount of time to rebut. What we call political debates aren't really debates. And pretty much all of them, people will interrupt each other somewhat. But this was so over the top. And I'm sure Trump went in with this intention. Don't let her talk. Because it's an opportunity to get the audience listening to you. It's an opportunity to silence the other party. But I think he got such a negative reaction to that he did less of it in the next debate, if I'm not mistaken about that.
I think it's true. He interrupted her 51 times. This is according to Vox. She interrupted him 17 times. But then I looked at some of the interruption numbers for a Joe Biden Trump debate last year, where Trump interrupted Biden 71 times and Biden interrupted him 22 times. So, you know, here's this brash New Yorker, right? And what, this is how they talk?
I would not tar my people that way.
Okay.
No, I think Trump was extreme, and it definitely seemed premeditated, planned. Don't let the other person say anything. So you can get your points across. And also it was a persona he was trying to put forth where he takes charge. And of course it's harder if it's a woman, because women who interrupt or perceived as interrupting will be judged more harshly. I think with Trump it was an extreme case, but it does definitely represent what happens at those debates. Here, way back in 2012, when it was Romney and Obama, there was a lot of talk about how frequently they were interrupting each other. Hmm. But there was a moment there when Obama was trying to interrupt Romney, and Romney said, "You'll get your chance in a moment. I'm still speaking." And the audience gasped because the tone was so patronizing. And I actually wrote about it at the time, and I said something like, they would not have gasped if he said something like, "Please let me finish." And I think now you do hear people saying that more.
Well, speaking of that, let me play a compilation. This is from last year, 2020, vice presidential debate between candidate Kamala Harris and then Vice President Mike Pence. Pence trying to interject as Harris discusses Trump's tax plans and his handling of the pandemic. This is three clips in one.
He said, because the president wanted people to remain calm.
Well, let's get
so
to
I, that. No, but Susan, I, this is important.
Susan,
I want to add, but
if,
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
I have to
I'm
weigh
speaking.
In.
Yeah, let's talk about packing the court then. Let's talk about the
Please.
Fact. Yeah, I'm about to.
$400,000
a year.
He said he's going to repeal the Trump tax cuts.
Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Well,
I'm speaking.
It'd be important if you said the truth.
Yes. If you don't mind letting me finish, we can
Please.
Then have a conversation, okay?
Please.
Okay.
Deborah, she says, "I'm speaking."
Yes, and she said it over and over. I'm sure this too was planned, and I think it worked well. I think it was a good advice that she got, I'm sure, from the people who were prepping her for the debate. I'm speaking is a way of saying, "Don't interrupt me," but in a way that focuses on what she's doing and doesn't attack him or criticize him for what he's doing. And because, as I said, women, it's particularly difficult for women because they can be seen as aggressive in a way when they do things that had a guy done it, it would not come across that way. But yeah, she kept her, I would say, her composure, and also the sense that she was treating him with respect. Again, polar opposite of the patronizing tone that Romney had used with Obama. She calls him Mr. Vice President, which in itself shows, I'm giving you the respect you deserve, but I'm claiming my rights to the floor by saying I'm speaking. I thought that was effective. But of course, he was not doing what Trump was doing, which is never backing off, just continuing at it like machine gun fire.
Almost up in a break here, but Rick has a comment. And then he says, I've generally heard that women speak 4,000 words per minute and men 2,000. Is that true? Do women use more words than men? Do we talk more than men, Deborah Dannon?
It depends on the context. I sometimes refer to this as public speaking and private speaking. If you record how many times the words women use during the day and include at home with family, women tend to talk more. There are cultural differences there, too, and individual differences. But in public, at a meeting, then men tend to talk more. There was one study of a faculty meeting where the longest turn taken by any woman on the faculty was still shorter than the shortest turn taken by a man on the faculty.
And is that because, I mean, we're almost having a break here. Is she deferring to him, or is he just pushing her out of the conversation?
My take on it is he's just doing what he thinks is appropriate, you know, taking his turn. But women are far more cautious about taking the floor in public, and with good reason. If women and men talk equally, people think the woman talked more. They can be seen as too aggressive. They can be seen as putting themselves forward in a way that women aren't supposed to. But I also trace it to the way boys and girls learn to use language as kids growing up. This is a big part of my book, You Just Didn't Understand, where girls will have friendships, often just two girls, and they sit and they talk about personal things.
And we got to interrupt.
Okay.
No, I got to interrupt
because we'll pick it up later.
We will indeed. Yeah. Short break. We'll be right back. This is
supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with linguist professor and author Deborah Tannen about some of the give and take of communication, the language of listening, how we talk to each other and with each other, gender and cultural talking styles, and frankly, how to handle people who filibuster a conversation. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Deborah Tannen, you were talking about how boys and girls are, in a sense, taught or learn how conversational styles work and how we end up with different styles as grown-ups.
Yeah, I'd like to start with an anecdote that represents what the caller, what your listener was saying, that studies show women talk more than men. I was giving a talk to a group in a living room, you know, a casual group. Many couples were there. And there was one couple sitting on the couch, and they just kind of stood out because they were holding hands, but the woman never said a word the entire evening, and the guy was one of the more talkative people. Not in any obstructive way, but he had comments, he had questions. It was just noticeable. And when I got to the point of saying that women tend to talk more at home, this guy said, yeah, she's the talker in our family. And everybody laughed because she hadn't opened her mouth. And he looked a little hurt, and he said, but it's true, at the end of the day, when I come home, she's the one who talks, and if she didn't, we'd be spending the evening in silence.
Wow.
But here he was doing the talking in this public situation. And I do trace it to the way boys and girls are using language as kids. This is not my own research. It's the research of those who have studied kids at play. In fact, one of the key ones was done by Marjorie Harness Goodwin right there in Philadelphia, where she did her dissertation research. And she found that the girls tended to use talk to create connections between them. So they would often talk in twos. Your best friend is the one you tell everything to. And the boys tended to play in larger groups, and they would try to get the floor to enhance their status in the group. So they would try to tell stories, maybe, or argue with someone who was telling a story to get the floor away from them. So the one who tended to talk more and to tell others what to do and they get them to listen was the leader. So I think often as they go through the day, for many women, the feeling is, I got to be careful when I'm out there. If I talk too much, people will think I'm taking more time than I should, and I might say something that might hurt somebody's feelings. So they kind of monitor themselves. Now I'm home with somebody I'm close to, I'm free to talk. And I think for many men, it's the opposite. They're out there during the day, need to talk to get your respect. Now I'm home, I don't need to talk, we're close.
A quick follow-up to that. So when you have a group of women talking together, let's say they're five or six women, do they interrupt each other?
I love that. Yeah, and my own research has found this when I was studying I did of women and men at work, but others have too. In all women conversations, there's more overlap. But again, it's overlap. It's not interruption. So yeah, they talk along. There's a lot of, yeah, I know just what you mean. The same thing happened to me. So yeah, but it's more overlap as a way of creating that connection.
Let me get Jennifer, who's been very patient, Jennifer, to join our conversation. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times, Jennifer.
Hello. Professor Tannen, I took a class with you at Georgetown 20 years ago. And
oh, that's
I remember
so great.
It fondly. So my sister and I, we talk a lot. And it's just been interesting as I feel like I've developed my talking skills with other people. And I feel like I'm a very direct person. To her, that style is sometimes abrasive and, you know, like I don't care or dismissive. And I just think it's interesting because we're both in our early 40s. We're both new mothers. And it's just interesting how it all is coming together.
And Jennifer, it sounds like you talk a lot. Do you argue a lot, too?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I'd say, like, we do talk a lot. We talk a lot throughout the day, and it could be an argument that we kind of keep going throughout the day. But yeah, I mean, yes, we do argue in a good way.
Jennifer, could I ask who's older between the two of you?
I am older. I'm more outgoing. And so I know there's also that expectation. You know, she's told me she thinks very highly of me, and I'm like, you don't need to. I'm a normal person. Like, you don't have to think highly of me. I don't know. Yeah. So I know that there are expectations that our relationship has in our relationship.
And I asked about that because I expected that you were going to say you were the older. Of course, culture is one, you know, region where you grew up is one. But your place in the family constellation is very significant. And older sisters often talk in ways that we associate with people in authority. And what you just described is part of that, her somewhat being intimidated by you because you're the older one.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's,
I told
that's,
her to
that's
listen,
very
so.
Common.
Well, hopefully she's listening.
Tune in. Yeah.
You also said you're outgoing. I'm sorry.
You're more outgoing,
Jennifer.
Now we're
both waiting.
Yeah. I just met a new friend at the gym, just this morning. And even then, I was just thinking about our conversation. Like, what am I telling this person? Am I telling them too much information? And and everybody's wearing masks. So it's like, you can't even, that adds a whole nother level to things when people are wearing masks, I found.
Well, Jennifer, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I do hope that your sister is listening. She can call us as well if she'd like to. Let me pick up on something she said. I have the same question, Deborah Tannen, about wearing masks and if you think that affects how we converse with each other, how we feel when we're in conversation with another person when, you know, half their face is missing.
Oh, it does definitely. For one thing, you can't tell whether people are smiling or not. You kind of can if you get attuned to those wrinkles around the eyes. But smiling is a way that women in particular, but again, people generally show their involvement, show they're well-disposed to the person they're talking to. So I think masks are definitely a problem there. And there's also just the fact that because of the lockdown and because we've been avoiding in-person interaction, people just feel kind of, again, I would use that word rusty. I remember one guy was telling me it was one of his first encounters. It was kind of a gathering. And someone came up to him and said, I don't think we've met. You know, my name's Steve. And he said, hi, Steve. And after a pause, he said, and you are? And he said, oh, I completely forgot. Right. I forgot how to do this. You say your name, I'm supposed to say mine. So I think we're all kind of relearning to have conversations.
Well, hopefully it's like riding a bike, that once you do it, you know, there those skills are. Let me read a comment from Bill. What do you think about how the nature of conversations change when people are talking on cell phones? The need to never have a moment of silence is such a distraction that they're talking on the phone while driving is dangerous, even when using them hands-free. I know we talk louder on cell phones, it seems. I'm not sure exactly why. But has that changed the nature of conversation, Deborah Tannen?
I think it has. I think people tend to speak more loudly because of a sense that the person is farther away, even though the voice may even be easier to hear on the cell phone. But I think texting has become the norm for many people as a way to have conversations. So a conversation even with somebody you're pretty close to on the cell phone, there's a feeling that this is particularly important. You don't just call people like you used to, you text first, you know, what's a good time? And it's harder to do the overlap with cell phones. It certainly used to be the case, I believe it still is, that you really can't have two voices going at once.
Right.
And so that does throw the rhythm that you're used to somewhat off. I would talk about conversations on Zoom, where people do find it hard to figure out exactly when you're supposed to take the floor.
Yeah, and raising your hand and, yeah, all of that. And then forgetting, of course, to turn your mic on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which doesn't help the conversation. Robert asks, is there a difference between the way introverts and extroverts communicate and converse? If I can just add something to that, I have a family member who is an introvert and is not a big talker. And when I'm with her, there are these long silences. And in my earlier days, I used to, you know, do everything I could to fill a silence. Now I have learned uncomfortably to be able to sit in silence. But I'm just curious about the introvert-extrovert.
I'm so glad for that question. I was actually going to say that in response to Jennifer. I asked, on the one hand, who's the older sister? And then I was also going to say there could be an introvert-extrovert difference. So absolutely. This really became significant in a book I wrote about friends, where introverts will say, I don't need that many friends. I just need one. And after I've been with them for a while, I need to get away to recharge. As people often say, the tendency is for that introverts lose energy to people and extroverts get energy from people. So it's almost a parallel to that, what I call high involvement style, where the more overlap there is, the more energy there is, the more fired up you are versus it exhausts you. So yeah, that is definitely a factor.
Here's a comment from Beth. How do you gauge how someone will respond to overlapping conversation? Some people get angry if you step on their words and others are fine with it, but how do you know? Deborah Tannen?
Yeah, you need to develop antenna and try to pick up indications whether they're, first of all, is there a long period during which they're not taking the floor? When they do start to speak, does it sound kind of frustrated? And you can actually, the word we sometimes use is meta-communicate, talk about the communication. So you can even ask, do you feel like I'm interrupting you? Or push yourself to speak when you think it's a little more quickly than you think is appropriate. But yeah, it's about antenna, and it's about picking up small cues.
Pamela says, how do you handle it when people won't give you an opening to end a conversation? I'm just thinking about, you know, those people who do filibuster a conversation. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that is a challenge. And many people take advantage of the fact that if you're telling a story, nobody can interrupt. And so you just drag out that story and you, that floor is going to be yours. Yeah, I think you can push yourself to speak. You can use a hand gesture as if you were in a classroom.
Raise your hand.
Yeah. Just to get their attention and say, you know, there's something I need to say here. You might say, I'm really enjoying, if you, maybe you need to go. You know, I'm really enjoying this, but I just want to say, I need to, or you make up a reason to get away. Somebody's going to be calling me on my cell, or you have to come up with some reason that you want to cut them off. Or you just push yourself to start speaking and talk over them till they stop.
You wrote a book, I think it was back in 1998, The Argument, Culture Stopping America's War of Words. You wrote that, right, Deborah Tannen?
Oh, I did, yes.
Well, here we are in 2021, and we're at each other's throats. More arguing, is there more interrupting, you know, just more combative conversations?
Absolutely more combative, something that I wrote about with that book, that there's a sense often among the press, as in talking about radio shows or journalists, that people are going to be interested in a fight. Fights are fun to watch.
Yep.
But if everybody's fighting, you just shut it out. And makes everybody feel vulnerable. Unfortunately, I wrote that book before the internet had taken over our lives, and I think that's made it much, much worse. Even back then, I observed that it's easier for people to be aggressive if there's nobody right in front of them. And there seems almost to be an ethic of the internet that encourages really vicious attacks. And it makes everybody feel vulnerable. It's corrosive to the human spirit. So I'm sad about how right on I was back then.
Amazing. As I say, written in 1998. Let me read a couple more comments before we have to say goodbye. John says, jazz is the perfect analog to conversation. Joan says, I grew up in West Virginia. We're talking more slowly and telling a story in a roundabout way is the accepted interactive style. I moved to the East Coast and have had to learn how to speak more quickly and understand the argumentative conversational style of my Jewish East Coast in-laws. And a comment from Tony, I watch a lot of Japanese news and the panelists always shake their heads in agreement when anyone is talking. Americans also use head gestures to show agreement or signal that you are listening. Anything you want to add to that, Deborah Tannen, before we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, just that the Japanese in particular, I love because it's the same thing, but in a slightly different way. And cultural differences tend to be that way. We all have ways to show we're listening. And it's just about respect for difference and realizing that our assumption that there's one right way may not be right. And just step back and say, could there be a cultural difference here before we blame each other?
Well, Deborah Tannen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thanks for all your work and thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much. And she is professor of linguistics at Georgetown University. She's written a bunch of books, including one that was written back in 1990, You Just Don't Understand, Women and Men in Conversation. And her most recent book is a memoir entitled Finding My Father. Go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times under Programs. You can also download a podcast of our show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us.